With its lush botany and timeless design, Hidcote in Gloucestershire is one of the country's most enchanting gardens, and this year marks the 75th anniversary since it came into trust care. In this feature, garden designer and broadcaster Chris Beardshaw explains its enduring appeal. It's read by Glenn McCready.
My first encounter with Hidcote Garden in Gloucestershire remains brilliant in my memory. I first visited as a child of eight, tumbling out of my parents' sweltering car and into what felt like a garden refuge. I roamed across immaculate lawns, rich in sweet fragrance from a summer cut. My hands brushed the textured foliage of the tapestry hedges, and I marvelled at the boisterous borders full of exotic blooms under an azure sky. In that moment, as a child at Hidcote, I became a gardener, in my own mind at least. I had already been exposed to horticulture growing up, firstly at my father's precise and methodical allotment, and secondly at my grandmother's chaotic ornamental garden, where a plant's ability to survive was reason enough for its inclusion. What drew me to Hidcote was the effortless harmony of the perfectly cultivated plants which had been choreographed to provoke an emotional response. It was a lesson in the impact of beautiful spaces on our well-being. I'm far from the first or last gardener to be so taken by Hidcote. It has a unique place in the history of the National Trust, as it was the first garden the charity took on for its own sake, rather than as part of a mansion or great estate. 75 years later, Hidcote is still considered one of the UK's most influential arts and crafts-inspired gardens. Remarkably, more than a century after it was created, it continues to evoke the quiet, revolutionary spirit of its era, even as it inspires generations of contemporary gardeners and designers. But this most photographed and celebrated garden was never intended as an exhibition piece or site of reverence. The garden emerged not from a single grand plan, but organically, over the course of 40 years, out of the curious mind of its escapist creator, Lawrence Johnston. I find that attempting to understand his personality helps explain the unique character and temperament of the garden to me. Lawrence Johnston's upbringing made him something of an enigma. He was born in Paris to a wealthy American family and was largely educated at home in Paris and London before attending Cambridge University in 1893. After university, Johnston travelled north to Northumberland to become a farming pupil, revealing an early inclination for the outdoor life. His father was a veteran of the American Civil War, and Johnston followed his father's military footsteps, becoming a British citizen and then serving in the Second Boer War. Johnston showed some early signs of a burgeoning interest in gardening. One was a beautiful little rock garden he created while lodging at Little Shelford in Cambridge in 1902. His horticultural flair might have been further kindled during his first posting to South Africa in 1900, because by 1904 he has been elected as a Fellow of the Royal Horticultural Society, where he's known to have frequently borrowed books from the Society's library. Johnston would go on to revisit South Africa later in life on plant collecting expeditions to find rare species to bring home to his garden. But this was just one side of him, as Johnston was, by all accounts, a conflicted soul. Rarely photographed looking directly at a camera, he valued privacy over the limelight and seemed content with his dogs and fellow gardeners. Johnston's mother had hoped that he would one day become a member of the landed gentry, and so she bought him the 120-hectare Hidcote Manor in 1907 as a canvas for him to realise her dream. But instead of cultivating a great estate, Johnston turned most of his attention to gardening. He hired an unemployed local named Frank Adams to be his head gardener, and in 1907 began nurturing the landscape. The pair started by laying what's known as the Old Garden. Visitors today can still enjoy their scheme of informal herbaceous borders with froths of bulbs and shrubs in soft colours set off by the bricks of the manor's old walled garden. Next, they created the White Garden with its singular colour theme of white petals against fresh green foliage. The White Garden demonstrates how Johnston took inspiration from the arts and crafts movement as he paired clipped, formal, medieval-style hedging with wild and naturalistic planting, all in white. These two garden rooms are excellent examples of Johnston's vision to create a wild garden in a formal setting, and were his first tentative steps towards the fully realised garden that visitors enjoy today. Many of Hidcote's admirers believe that these are his most refined and structurally eloquent garden designs. Finding his stride, Johnston developed the next stages of his garden with striking confidence. He created a visual link from the old walled garden by making an axis where two gardens would sit. The first was the elegant French classical style stilt garden with fiercely trimmed hornbeam hedges on top of exposed trunk stilts. At a right angle, he built an Italianate bathing pool, flanked by topiary birds and soundtracked by a burbling statue fountain. Quite remarkably, as well as being beautiful in their own right, these linked spaces formed the structure from which all of the following character gardens flowed. In one move, Johnston had secured the design integrity of the whole future scheme. Neither Johnston nor Adams were proven garden creators, yet together they had crafted a quite extraordinary canvas. This would have been an accomplishment for any proficient landscape designer, but for a self-taught horticulturist and novice designer, it was remarkable. Hidcote's success as a garden is testament to Johnston's appetite for knowledge, sensitive eye, and understanding of staging and styling plants. Johnston didn't leave many records, so we don't fully know where his primary sources of inspiration came from, but the influence of the arts and crafts movement courses through the garden. You can see its aesthetic play out in the topiary hedges and stonework walls of the garden rooms, reflecting the principle of a seamlessly connected inside and outside, and through the authentically wild planting schemes, rich in texture and colour, with nature front and centre. You can see how the arts and crafts movement might have appealed to the creative yet introverted Johnston. It had emerged as an antithesis to industrial practices, putting its focus instead on handcrafting, artistic intelligence, and a romantic belief that creativity is most authentic when the artist is immersed in nature. It's likely Johnston drew on two prominent contemporary references, Thomas Mawson and William Robinson. Mawson, a millworker's son from Lancashire, who, like Johnston, was self-taught, honed his skills in architecture and classical arrangement. He published The Art and Craft of Garden Making in 1900, which became a definitive guide to gardening and design. You can see Mawson's preferred formal structure and geometric layout reflected at Hidcote. By contrast, William Robinson was a graduate of Glasnevin Gardens near Dublin, who preferred a natural, relaxed style. His 1870 book, The Wild Garden, encouraged informal planting, which respected individual plant colour, form, and aesthetic personality over a strict planting layout. Robinson mixed native and exotic species, sowed lawns with swathes of bulbs and planted shrubs, herbaceous and annuals, in a new, naturalistic style. Johnston's greatest achievement might be the way he took these two approaches and blended them. He gave each of Hidcote's 28 garden rooms its own character, but he also carefully considered the way they would work together as a whole. In less skilled hands, such formal arrangements might run the risk of becoming claustrophobic, but Johnston uses a sleight of hand which, just at the point of sensory overload, shows real finesse. The pillar garden is an example of one of his snug rooms, where walls of conical yew trees give way to fountains of brightly coloured and richly textured flora playing at their base. Their enclosed spaces contrast with the broad vistas and monumental scale of the theatre lawn, beech allee, and long walk, which all offer airiness and breathing space. At particular points, he uses the garden's natural elevation to frame distant views, drawing them into the heart of the scheme. By the early 1920s, the garden layout was complete, and Johnston concentrated on furnishing it with newly discovered plants and exotic rarities, many of which he collected himself on plant hunting expeditions. These were Hidcote's glory days. People flocked to visit, including garden designer Nora Lindsay and Vita Sackville-West and Harold Nicholson, who were in the process of creating their own garden at Sissinghurst in Kent. The garden was open to the public, too, two or three times a year, to raise money for various charities. By the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939, Johnston, now in his 70s, put his mind to the long-term future of his beloved garden. He approached the National Trust in 1943, who, after deliberating, decided to accept Hidcote in 1948 as their first garden of national importance under a gardens fund launched jointly by the Trust and the Royal Horticultural Society to save such gardens. For me, Hidcote is one of the few gardens whose spaces can simultaneously excite me with their style and structure, while reassuring me with an enveloping calm. I find myself stumbling across views I've never seen before, a previously quiet corner blossoming in a new way. The way the garden responds to seasons, weather, and maturity delights me. It's a work of art. The 75th anniversary of the Trust's relationship with Johnston's garden brings a reminder of the vulnerability of such garden spaces. I think it's vital to stay true to his original vision, preparing the garden to inspire the next generation of horticulturalists and garden creators.
Hidcote in the Cotswolds is beautiful, and there are other arts and crafts gardens in Trustcare too. Olivia and Akia highlight a few you can wander through now.
Boddis Gathlin Hall in Conwy is one of the Trust's three historic house hotels. Boddis Gathlin offers views over Conwy Castle and beyond to the craggy peaks of Eryri or Snowdonia National Park. Guests can enjoy the arts and crafts garden, which includes a walled rose garden and herb-scented parterre.
Goddard's in North Yorkshire is the 20th century family home of Noel Goddard Terry, owner of the chocolate-making firm Terry's. Goddard's was designed by architect Walter Briley in the arts and crafts style. Just outside York, this haven has garden rooms filled with scented borders, trees and ponds.
Wander through the intimate medieval manor house, Lights Carey Manor in Somerset, which was restored in the early 20th century by Sir Walter Jenner. Discover topiary sculptures such as the 12 apostle yew trees, a peacock, domes, and cloud-shaped hedges, or relax in the lavender garden or orchard.
The warm red brick Red House in London is enclosed by its garden, with plants chosen to evoke the 1860s when William Morris lived here. Morris thought of the house and garden as one and divided the garden into small enclosures surrounded by hurdles.
And the 5-hectare garden of Standon in West Sussex is the creation of a self-taught gardener, Margaret Beale, who was inspired by the arts and crafts movement. Visit and take in the different spaces, from the house terrace to Goose Green, with its plane trees and views.